Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, filling in for Craig Cohen today. Frederick Hoxie is a Swanland Professor of History, Law, and American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois, often at the Urbana campus, but he's in Chicago today, so we're talking to him by phone. Professor Hoxie, good morning.
Good morning.
And you start off your book, This Indian Country, with something that you say you ask your students at the start of every course that you teach on Native American history. So could you tell me what it is you ask your students?
I ask them to take out a piece of paper and write down the names of three Indians. What are the three Indian people names that come first to their minds? And I ask them that not as a quiz at the beginning of the course, but really to sort of say, what do we know? What do people have in their heads about American Indian people? And for many years, the same three answers have appeared with pretty great regularity. Crazy Horse, Geronimo, and Sitting Bull.
And what does that tell you about Native Americans, or perhaps what does it tell you about what we know or think we know about Native American history?
Well, it's always a good way to start a discussion about what the popular image of American Indians and American Indian history is, because, and I should say that sometimes Pocahontas noses her way onto the platform with one of the three, but the figures that people think of when they think of American Indian history tend to be people from the past, and those, of course, those big three are male warriors who are most famous for opposing American expansion. Now, those were great leaders, and they did oppose American expansion. But if that's all we remember about who American Indian people are, it's a very cramped and narrow view of American Indian history. So I use the exercise really as a way to say, what else might we want to know? And then beyond that, if we look around us and see that there are hundreds of thousands of American Indians living in the United States today, there are dozens and dozens of tribal governments and Indian enterprises and a whole range of activities taking place in the Indian world, how do we explain all of that if Indian history consists of dead warriors? How do we find an answer to that? And in a sense, my book was really written to try to answer that question.
And that's what we'll be talking about, and those are the people we'll be talking about during this hour of Focus. And listeners, we welcome you to the conversation as well. To join us on the air, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on WILL's Facebook page. And the people we're talking about, they were not warriors. Were they people who knew the warriors? Was there any back and forth between, say, the political diplomatic side of American Indian governments and the warriors?
Yes, well, in order to sort of tell this story, I decided the most effective way to do it was to try to profile people who were not warriors, people who were politicians and who were writers and speakers and lecturers and activists and insurgents of various kinds. And these were all from Native communities who had had moments of resistance, had had periods of resistance, but had reached a point where at least these activists, I call them, had decided that the best strategy was to try to find a way to peacefully make a place in American political life and American public life for Indian people. So in many ways, these are the people who came after periods of warfare, or people who were taking the other tact at a period of time. But most of the people I'm writing about were people who were who chose the path of negotiation and lobbying rather than military resistance.
I wonder if we could focus on, early in the book, where you focus on one point in American history, and I guess that's just after the American Revolution, with really the birth of the United States as a nation. And it hadn't occurred to me before that the birth of the United States itself, as compared to simply the colonies being there, presented a turning point for Native Americans and not necessarily one they welcomed.
It really marked the beginning of a completely different era for Indian people, for indigenous people in North America. Prior to the American Revolution, there had been a very complex relationship between native communities and settlers, and there had been periods of contention and the expansion of colonial regimes and the contraction of some native regimes, but Indian people and indigenous people across the continent had diplomatic recognition. Indian nations had allied themselves with the British during the American Revolution. And there was really the idea was that North America was filled with all of these different groups of people, settlers being one of them, but of course others being the Iroquois in the northeast and the Cherokees in the southeast and so on. And these were all governments. And in European view, they were not particularly, they weren't necessarily equal, but that they were viable governments that had diplomatic recognition. And that's why the British and the European powers, the British, the French, and the Spanish, were sort of shocked at the end of the American Revolution when the American revolutionaries insisted on placing the boundary of their new country at the Mississippi River. There were no significant American settlements west of the Appalachian. There were some thousands of people in Kentucky. But beyond that, this was Indian country where these Indian nations existed. And so the American diplomats in Paris were asking for something that was not only shocking to the Europeans, but it also signaled a shift to a new way of defining nationhood in North America, and that was a space that was for settlers and not for Indians. And so the title of the first chapter is erased from the map, and essentially, and there's a long story as to how the Americans pulled off this diplomatic maneuver, but in effect, they erased Indian nations as recognized international bodies from the map of the eastern, what became the eastern United States.
But at the same time, Native Americans were not passive about this, and your book is about some efforts to resist or at least negotiate in the situation.
Certainly. Well, the story is one of conflict as well as negotiation, because the fighting surrounding the War of 1812 in the early 19th century is people like Tecumseh and others who are militarily resisting this American expansion. But I pick up my story of activists really at the end of the War of 1812, when the Americans have asserted their military control over the eastern part of the continent. And it's really at that point that Indians really take to heart this new era and really attempt to sort of figure out a way and talk among themselves and really try to strategize over how to find a place for Indian people within this nation state.
Were there competing ideas among the Native Americans as to what should be done, and what were those ideas?
Well, that's a great question. There were those who said, let's just leave, let's migrate. In fact, there were groups of people that migrated to Mexico, people went across the border to Canada, and so on. So there were disputes about that. There were also differences over religious ideas, people who would just retreat and say, we're going to follow a new religious leader and we're going to sort of tune out politics. So there were, as in any community, there were people who had different ideas. But the people who I focus on are people who viewed treaties as promises, and who had negotiated treaties, even though they knew that they were at disadvantage in terms of military power, they were willing to take up the American offer to negotiate treaties and agreements between Native communities and the United States government. And they really began to press this idea of treaties as promises, treaties as contracts, and they began to assert that they really held rights within those treaties. These were a number of ideas that the Americans really hadn't thought of when they began treaty making with Indians. They thought of them as kind of peace accords and ways of sort of smoothing the waters after conflict. But it was really using the opening of treaties and treaty negotiations in the beginning of the 19th century that Indians began to make some headway in making a place for themselves in the American nation state.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guest is University of Illinois History Professor Frederick Hoxie. And we're discussing American Indian political activists throughout history. They're the topic of Professor Hoxie's new book, This Indian Country. It's published by the Penguin Press. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. Going back to the book, one of the first parts that grabbed me was the discussion of the treaty making between the federal government and the Choctaw tribe, and this would take us up to about what point in American history?
1830.
In the 1830s, and was Andrew Jackson president during all of that period of negotiations, or just during part?
Well, actually, Andrew Jackson rose to political power on the strength of his confrontations with southeastern tribes. So he was a Tennessee politician and a local militia commander when he first encountered the Choctaws. He was sent by President Monroe to negotiate treaties with the Choctaws. And this chapter is built around a man named James McDonald, who I call the first Indian lawyer, who was a remarkable young man who was educated by Quakers and read law and became a lawyer in the 1820s. And as a young man, when he came back to his community, he arrived back in Mississippi after going away and being trained just at the moment when Andrew Jackson began these treaty negotiations, and the tribes were faced with the demands that they remove that they leave Mississippi and move west. So he is a key figure here in sort of beginning to sort of start this debate, saying, well, we have a treaty, we have rights that you've already granted us. Under what power can you force us to do something different? He really begins to sort of use a legal argument to defend Indian rights and Indian territories. Unfortunately, Jackson is a tremendously popular figure in the 1830s. This movement towards reform, towards removal, is something that the Indians really can't resist. And there's a long story involving the Cherokees and the Trail of Tears and so on. So that even though McDonald is an obscure figure and his arguments are swept away by the forces of the day, those arguments surface again and again later in the 19th century. They're picked up by Cherokee politicians in Oklahoma, what's now Oklahoma, in the 1840s and 50s. They're picked up by other people across the continent later on. So it really is the kind of the birth of what later becomes federal Indian law, which becomes a very powerful tool for Indian people.
And there seems to be
in that earlier moment.
And there seems to be a document that crystallizes that set of ideas, one called the Choctaw Declaration. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Again, remarkable figure about whom very little has been written in the past. McDonald accompanies tribal elders, men a generation older than he, who, to Washington, D.C. in 1824. And they go to Washington to negotiate a treaty, and McDonald goes along as a kind of a secretary. But once they're in Washington, the leaders realize that he's very adept at dealing with white people and reducing various proposals to writing and so on. And so he becomes a sort of key negotiator as they negotiate a fairly successful treaty in that year of 1824-5. But what happens what's interesting is they leave town. The Choctaws write a memorial to Congress, which is published in the records of the U.S. Congress. And it's just a remarkable document in which he says, "You are people of the law, and because you are people of the law, you will protect our rights." So he's really kind of turning the table on them and saying, if you really are as civilized as you say you are, you will live up to the promises you've made with us. Now, as I said, he was a voice in the hurricane in the 1820s and 30s. But that plea and that argument, which was reinforced and found allies among the white community and so on, became very powerful later in the century.
I may want to pick up on that a little bit later, but right now we do have a call waiting patiently. Jeff, out on I-55, and hello, you're on Focus. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning. Hey, I was kind of sad to see how these reservations are being kept up. I, on occasion, am able to go through some of the ones in Arizona and Missouri, and it's just so sad. It seems like some of the nation's poorest people are in there. And, you know, if you look at the history of the cowboys and Indians and, you know, the back in the 1800s and so forth, we kind of drove them out of their land. When you watch movies and you watch TV shows and things of that nature, it portrays them in a different light, like you were the bad savages and you know, some of the stuff is still in schools that is not true. I'm surprised they haven't changed it, but it just surprises the heck out of me, and it's so disgusting that we don't do something for these people. It just seems like they're at the bottom of the totem pole, or the bottom of the, you know, the money barrel when it comes to government-issued stuff. You know what I mean? It's a government entity, and it just seems like we run them in the ground. I don't know. I don't understand that. But anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. Thanks, guys. Bye.
Thank you for calling. And Professor Hoxie, that's making a jump, I guess, from where from about 200 years ago to the situation for Native Americans. And
it's interesting. It is sort of the other end of my story, but it's a very important observation that people often make, that there are issues of poverty and social dislocation on many reservations and so on. But that popular view, and it's important for people to remember, of course, the areas where there are problems. But it's also important to recognize that Native American communities on reservations are Indian governments, are governed by Indian people, and are, in many cases, enterprising communities. It's only been in the last generation, really, that Native American communities have been able to function really sort of the same way that towns and counties do in other parts of North America. So if you take a community like the Oneidas outside of Green Bay, Wisconsin, they're able to manage their own school system. They have a museum. They have tribal businesses and enterprises. They're a major employer in Brown County, Wisconsin. It's not that there are no social problems or that poverty has been eliminated, but that community is functioning autonomously, functioning, making its own rules, making its own laws. And that ability to function autonomously, to create your own community, those are the results of activists beginning all the way back with James McDonald, making a place for these communities to function in modern society. So much of what we see today, I think, is really cost of the past, of dislocations and theft, frankly, of the past. But there is, I don't mean to be a Pollyanna about it, but there's a tremendous amount of progress that's been made in communities around the country. And legally and politically, there is now no question that Indian communities have the right to run their own communities, to have their own schools, their own police force, and all the rest of it.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows in for Craig Cohen, and we're talking with University of Illinois History Professor Frederick Hoxie about his new book from the Penguin Press, This Indian Country, American Indian Political Activists and the Place They Made. To join the conversation, call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email will-talk@illinois.edu. Again, that's 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. You know, one thing I was thinking as we were talking about the Choctaw negotiations is the power equation, which was very much to the advantage of the federal government. And I was thinking of maybe a difference between the Native Americans and, to say, people who were colonized by European powers in, say, Africa or Asia, is that there just seem to be so much fewer of Native Americans. I've heard about the issues of diseases spread by Europeans, which severely cut into Native American numbers. Was that a factor in what Native Americans were able to, you know, bring to the table when it came to dealing with Europeans?
Absolutely. And many of these activists were in communities that suffered tremendously from dislocation from the arrival of outsiders. Another chapter in the book is written about Sarah Winnemucca, who was a Paiute activist in Nevada in the 1870s and 80s. And she actually grew up it's sort of in the middle of the highway leading to California for the California Gold Rush. Her community and her family were living right in the area where the California Trail crossed Nevada into California. So she witnessed all of these things that were going on around them. But what's so remarkable about these people is that they were so tenacious and so courageous that they and visionary in a way that it's very hard to imagine, to be surrounded by a sort of a chaotic and tragic situation and to say, I think there's a way out of this, and this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to make this kind of an argument, and I'm going to travel around the country. I'm going to look for allies in the white community. I'm going to lobby Congress. These kinds of things, I think, are quite remarkable. It doesn't mean that there aren't other ways of doing it, but by forgetting them, I think we forget the tremendous energy and a drive that these people had, as well as what a remarkably kind of American story it is of people trying to make the institutions work for their communities.
I want to go over to a caller now and say hello to Pam in Urbana, and I think you wanted to talk about not a historical event, but something that's going on right now.
Yes, I did. I just felt like it was relevant in the sense that you were saying that they have their own governments in these communities, in these reservation areas, and you know, and I'm sorry to say that I'm not sure what tribe this is, but I heard a documentary a while back about hemp production, and that's illegal in the United States apparently, but it was a reservation that was doing this. They were growing hemp, and they were using it for construction materials and all kinds of things. It was beginning to really help them in their local economy. And apparently, the DEA came in and destroyed the whole crop. And so my question is, how much autonomy do they have in terms of what are their legal rights?
Uh-huh. Maybe they should move that business to Colorado. They probably do really well there.
Well, I'm wondering about that now that some states have legalized through referendum recreational marijuana use.
Well,
they may be seeing these same conflicts with the federal government where it is still illegal.
Well, but the more fundamental point is that there are points of conflict, certainly, between these communities and the communities around them. There's been issues of whether endangered species laws apply to Indian communities. Environmental protection regulations, do Indian communities have to follow them, and so on. There are thousands of lawyers out there right now working on all of these kinds of questions, personal liability for Indian businesses that hire people and so on, where their accidents take place in their communities. To what extent are these communities separate nations? To what extent are they part of a state government and so on? But the fundamental point is that these communities are there. They have defined themselves. They have been accepted really across the political spectrum. They're in blue states and they're in red states of people who recognize that Indians have the right to control and to create their own communities. That said, there certainly are a whole range of questions about taxation and regulation that remain to be litigated and are ongoing. And to be honest, they're all taking place under the sovereignty of the United States. So, one famous example is: can someone capture endangered species of eagles to take eagle feathers for a religious ceremony? The Supreme Court has said no. There is a federal regulation about endangered species, and so that's off the books. So, it's a complicated process of adjustment between tribal governments today asserting their rights and the governments around them.
And you know, I just Googled Native American hemp production and DEA, and the first thing I came up with was somebody's blog entry from really quite a few years ago, about 2008, and then it's referring back to even an older I think article in Indian Country Today from like 11 years ago about the dispute, which seems to involve the Lakota people. It quotes a letter to the U.S. attorney from the Ogala tribal president, John Yellowbird Steele, who cites the Controlled Substance Act of 1970 as something that, quote, did not divest the Lakota people of our reserved right to plant and harvest whatever crops we deem beneficial to our reservation. Obviously something that the federal government disagrees with, and I don't know how that's been settled in the decades since John Yellowbird Steele wrote that letter.
But this is a very rural community in West western South Dakota, looking for a way to raise crops in an area that is arid and where the cattle industry is on the ropes and so on. And I don't know the later chapters of that. I thought that it had been an Oglala case, but so that there certainly are exceptions, and there are ways in which Native communities can function that where their actions may be recognized by federal authorities, but in general, there's a lot more activity taking place in business and in government that is permitted. Then these are not being closely monitored, regulated, constrained by outside forces. In my opinion, they're much more vibrant than we might think.
Okay, I want to thank the caller for bringing that idea up into the discussion here, and we're going to take a short break right now. This is Focus. And we're back on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're discussing the contributions made by American Indian political activists, lawyers, writers, politicians, and others. And their work is the subject of U of I Professor Frederick Hoxie's book, This Indian Country, from the Penguin Press. Professor Hoxie, we are talking about people who are not on the battlefront, the literal battlefront in American Indian history. But I'm about to take a call here from someone who I believe wants to talk about one of the warrior chiefs.
Okay.
And Ernest from Champaign, you're on the air on Focus.
Right. Don't know that for a fact that Tecumseh was a warrior chief, but I understand that he had gone about to amalgamate some 14 or 15 Western tribes before the U.S. Army out of Terre Haute helped drive him and his brother out of the Wabash Valley and everybody west. Just comment, please.
Yes, Tecumseh was a remarkable strategist and diplomat. He was born in Ohio, and as he came of age, he and his brother formed an alliance. His brother, as you say, was a religious leader. And this is in the decade prior to the War of 1812, when the British, remember, occupied forts in the West at the end of the American Revolution and were a very powerful presence in the West. There were very few American settlers at this time. And Tecumseh had the idea that American Indians could ally themselves with the British and stop the American expansion. And what the Indians had always wanted at the time of the Revolution was the recognition of an Indian country somewhere in the Great Lakes area. So Tecumseh spent a great deal of time traveling through Mississippi and Alabama. He was in Wisconsin and different parts of the Midwest, attempting to rally tribes together to form a united front against the Americans. And when the War of 1812 started, he went to Detroit. He fought alongside the British, and he died in 1813 fighting alongside the British to try to stop the American expansion.
So what we're talking about in this case is someone who may be remembered for what he did on the battleground, but was just as important, it sounds like, as a politician, as a diplomat, for organizing the Indian nations.
Right, right. And my story really begins with the aftermath of that. That was probably the last, certainly not the last Indian War, but one of the last efforts to really collaborate and across a very large area of land to stop American expansion. Of course, at a time when the American government was quite small and weak.
And as the 19th century wore on, that became a more and more untenable idea.
Well, it became a much more complicated story, because there were parts of the country where conflict was still occurring and where there was the possibility, it seemed, of holding back the Americans or pushing them back. You have someone like Sitting Bull, who was never defeated by the Americans, who ended up going across the border into Canada. But that's why some kind of get pushed aside in the narrative, because while that's happening and there are these periods of conflict, there were, as a parallel track, there were these people like MacDonald and William Potter Ross, who I write about in the Indian Territory, which later became Oklahoma, Sarah Winnemucca, and others who are taking a different tact and are working at finding white allies, lobbying Congress, getting legislation passed or treaties approved that will make a space for them in this American nation state. They're not defeatists. there are people who are saying, this is the situation we're in, let's try this method for now for us.
I wanted the touch on Sarah Winnemucca, partly because I have linked her book, Life Among the Paiutes, to our website. And so if you go to will.illinois.edu/focus, you'll find a link to Sarah Winnemucca's book, which is billed as perhaps the first book written by an American Indian woman to be published in America. What did readers find in that book when it came out in 1883?
What you find that is so remarkable is you can hear her voice. She says the Americans came in like a lion. And she describes the American expansion into California and Nevada as like a lion raging into a new country. And she speaks very vividly about the experiences of her communities, about betrayals of various kinds, about violence and so on. It's a stirring story. She also describes her own community and its values and so on. And she really kind of makes the argument. In fact, she says very clearly late in the book, she says, "You who call yourself civilized," she said, How can you condone these things that I've been describing and so on? So it was written as a polemical book, written as a book to mobilize people and to win allies. It's very interesting also that it was published. It's a book that it's very difficult to know exactly how it was put together, but it appears that it was probably her lectures. She traveled the country giving lectures about Indian life and also about politics and about Indian social problems. And in the course of her travels, she befriended a pair of women's rights activists in Boston. And she became a close friend of theirs and actually lived with them for a few months, or about 6 months, it seems. And it was just after that point that the book was published, so with their help. So it seems to me that more from deduction than from anything Sarah said explicitly, that these the chapters in this book, they read like short, very punchy, very entertaining lectures. And together they make a very powerful case for the recognition of Indian people in the United States.
The idea of assimilation, and even going back to the Choctaw negotiations, I got the impression that the idea was out there, which essentially would have meant the elimination of the tribes, at least as any political structure that the federal government had to pay attention to, and then probably assimilation as second-class citizens going by the laws and customs in the states at that time. But I take it that was something that was pretty soundly rejected, and perhaps part of the reason that Native Americans, for the most part, were not U.S. citizens until the early 20th century.
Yes, even though these people who were, I again use the phrase, making a space for themselves in American life, even though they were finding a place within the United States, the word assimilation is really not one that works for them or really worked for Indian people in almost any of these moments, because assimilation is sort of a view from the outside or a view from the majority looking at a minority group and saying, let's have them absorbed into the larger community. From their perspective, their goal was to find a way to live within the borders of the United States, but to continue to be Indians. So citizenship in the tribe was the most important thing for most of this history. There were people, and I have a chapter called The Good Citizenship Gun about people that debate over citizenship. And the idea, obvious from the title, is that by becoming U.S. citizens, we could use the weapon of citizenship to defend our rights. So even though in the early 20th century, I write about a lawyer named Thomas Sloan, who was the first Indian lawyer to argue a case before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1905. He is an advocate of citizenship, but he's not an advocate of assimilation. He's not saying we're going to disappear and become like everybody else. We're going to become citizens so that we can better defend our rights in our community.
Well, Native Americans then do get citizenship in the 1920s, and on what terms do they get it?
Well, actually, citizenship process begins earlier. In the 1880s, there's a law passed called the Dawes-Severalty Act, which begins a process of dividing up reservations into individual homesteads. And as people took individual homesteads, they became U.S. citizens. But then by 1924, some people had been through this process, others hadn't. It was very complicated. And so there was a general grant of give to all American Indians.
But they still could remain on tribal lands with tribal governments?
Oh, yes. And that had been a principle that was very well established. In fact, Thomas Sloan was very important in that, in saying that by becoming, in fact, the Citizenship Act itself says by becoming U.S. citizens, people do not give up their rights as tribal members.
And that's something I was wondering about. Was that something that there must have been a big fight to get through? And maybe even at the point where citizenship came in, I get the impression that the federal government would have been happy to see the tribal governments disappear.
Well, yes, and it's a again, it's a complicated story, is what I often say with all these things. But the problem with the citizenship law and why it was not terribly controversial when it was approved is that the federal government also advanced the idea that by becoming U.S. citizens, the Indian Office did not give up any of its power to regulate the lives of Indian people. Remember, this is the time of segregation, the time of Jim Crow, and the idea that people could be citizens of the United States, as African Americans were, of course, after the Civil War, but who would not enjoy all of the complete freedoms of Americans, as African Americans did not. So there was a lot of thinking in the time this was passed that there could be a kind of partial citizenship or a kind of qualified citizenship, kind of like a driver's permit or something. And so there was there were a variety of ideas about what citizenship meant, and because the process had already begun in the 1880s, there was essentially a decision to approve everyone as citizens, but it was not a moment when the majority society embraced racial equality or even political equality for Indians or for other people as well.
So it might have been that when this was discussed at the table, even though there was an agreement at one point, it doesn't mean that the two sides necessarily saw things the same way.
Exactly.
This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, in for Craig Cohen, and we're talking with University of Illinois Swanland History Professor Frederick Hoxie about important American Indians who fought for their people, not on the battlefield, but in courtrooms, at the bargaining table, and in the pages of the books they wrote. Professor Hoxie's own book is This Indian Country, American Indian Political Activists, and the History They Made. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL or toll-free at 800-222-WILL. Going into the New Deal and then the World War II and afterwards, I sense there's a things seem to be gathering up speed as far as rights that American Indians are fighting for themselves. Abandoning there, but things do seem to be speeding up in that period.
One of the things that I try to trace in the book through the stories of these individuals is that their paths begin to cross with one another. It was so much fun to write this book, to discover people like James McDonald and Sarah Winnemucca and to portray them. But as I discovered them, I found that they overlapped with one another, that many of them knew each other. They traveled some of the same circuits. They made similar allies, or there were allies that knew one and knew another. And by the early 20th century, a lot of those paths led to Washington, D.C. I mentioned Thomas Sloan a minute ago. He was an Indian lawyer in Nebraska. He was an Omaha Indian, and he became active with other Indian people and in sort of the Indian rights movement loosely. There wasn't a single organization. But he moved to Washington, D.C., and became a kind of a advocate, lawyer, agent, lobbyist for Indian tribes that would come to Washington in the 1900s and the 19-teens. So by the time of the New Deal, there was a community of Native activists who knew the ropes in Washington. It was a small community, but many of them knew each other. And they also began to profit from shifts that were taking place in the larger society. Of course, American society has never stood still, and during the first three decades of the 20th century, American society is becoming more diverse. Immigrants are beginning to have more of a voice in American politics. African-American civil rights movement is beginning to accelerate. So the idea of granting people rights, of giving voice to minority communities, becomes a much more popular idea. And then, of course, in the aftermath of World War II, with a victory for democracy, defeating a racist enemy and so on. There is an accelerating sense of sympathy for Indian rights and for the kind of agenda that Indian people had been pushing now for over a century.
Some calls are piling up with us now. Let's go over to Bob from Urbana. And Bob, you're on the air on Focus. Good morning.
Good morning. I had a question. We have a crisis here with our pension funds, state pension funds. I understand the federal government did a similar thing with the Native Americans in keeping the money from their natural resources because they wouldn't know how to spend the money appropriately. And this has gone on for 1,000 years, millions of dollars in natural resources. Is that in fact true? And if so, I understand that there's no accounting as to how much money that is.
Yeah, there was a woman named Cobell, C-O-B-E-L-L, and she was a banker, American Indian banker, and she was managing, helping clients who had property that the federal government was holding in trust, and she began to discover that actually it has related to that process I mentioned earlier about dividing up reservations into individual plots of land. There are thousands and thousands of plots of land that had been assigned to individual Indians beginning in the 19th century and then assigned to their heirs and so on, passed through families, but were formally being managed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs, either leasing them for oil or gas or leasing them for ranching or farming or other purposes. And what she discovered as she dug into this is that, first of all, they'd been mismanaged, there'd been terrible problems with that, but also that the Bureau of Indian Affairs didn't have very good records on any of it. So she filed a class action suit on behalf of individual Native American landowners against the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Secretary of the Interior for mismanagement and asking for damages. This case stretched over, I think about 15 years before it was finally settled early in the Obama administration, and a cash award was made to the plaintiffs with congressional appropriation, which is in the billions of dollars, although it's divided by many thousands of people. But it was finally resolved.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
And that's maybe not quite the same as the situation with Illinois. There was a settlement. I don't think that settlement quite equaled the amount that the Native Americans had lost to the federal government, did it?
No, well, they in the end they really couldn't figure out what the number was supposed to be, and there were people who felt that it wasn't high enough, but it had gone on so long that people decided it was worth taking. But this was the management of their property, right? It was not something that was owed to Indians by the federal government, like a pension would be.
Okay, well, let's go up to another caller. Mary from Muhammad, you're on the air on Focus.
Yes. Hello. My former husband, his grandmother, great-grandmother in Indiana was full-blood Native American, as the family story goes. Unfortunately, the family did not honor their heritage, and so no information has been kept. And how do you go about finding out genealogy if you don't even know the tribe for Native Americans?
Well, it's very difficult. The place to begin is with whatever census records you can find that have the listing of the individual. The census would list someone's race. There may be some notation in the census records, depending on how far back you're going. These are available on microfilm, and you can actually see what the census taker wrote down for individual people in a household.
How do they indicate a Native American, assuming they even gave that information out?
Well, it would be by race, and so they might say Indian.
Okay.
And if you knew the area where it is in Indiana, for example, there's a Miami community, which there's been for many, many,
Well, it is Indiana, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, so, there are different
early 1900s, late 1800s.
Yeah, but depending on where it is, you might find an association between that name or that person and the tribe. And then tribal membership is a right exercised by tribal governments. So it's tribal governments that recognize. They have their own enrollment offices, and they have roles of members and that sort of thing. So if you had an idea about a tribe, you might go and see if you could find that family name among that tribe and so on. Right. But it's very difficult, and there are lots and lots of people who are in your boat, and it's a really sad fact that people have lost
their relatives. Oh, very sad. Would the tribe have kept a record of birth?
Not until the modern period, no.
I see. Wow, that is sad. I mean, that's such a noble ancestry to have, and then to not have be able to track it or trace it very well is a sorry indication of what happened to Native Americans in our country.
But the census records are a pretty remarkable source. It's worth a shot anyway, and it's a kind of an interesting project.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you, caller. And let's go ahead to another caller. We are kind of busy right now. And Ron from Atlanta, Illinois. And I think you had if I'm keeping up with the right number here, a question about Native Americans and photographers.
That's true. I'm called about Edward Curtis and the fact that at the time that he was taking his great number of photographs of the Indians, that the United States white side thought that the Indians would definitely go extinct in a short period of time. And I just wondered if any of the principals in the book helped Edward get access to Indians to take those pictures. That was not covered in the recent book that I read, and I just he seemed to get access that nobody was able to do, and I wondered if that was a possibility, and I'll shut up and hang up. Thank you.
Well, I'm afraid my answer is short. I really don't deal with Curtis. He is a fascinating character, and he did travel to dozens and dozens of Indian communities and interviewed people, and he not only took pictures, but he recorded the lives of individuals and so on. And that's a great story, but one of the figures in my book, Robert Yellowtail, a Crow leader, was living at the Crow Reservation and was involved when Curtis was there, but he was not directly involved with Curtis. So that's one topic I didn't cover.
Thank you, caller. And let's go ahead and talk to Jean from Terre Haute. Jean, you're on the air on Focus.
Yes, thank you. I have a question to see if you could perhaps speak to any sequelae that has happened as a result of the mid-70s uprisings on the in the Buffalo Gap Sioux Reservation area. I happen to have been a park ranger in the area at that time, and we were very sensitized to those issues. But I've really not heard much about what has happened, if anything, since then related to that.
Well, one of the leaders, if I have this right, of that from that era was Russell Means, who
mm-hmm.
died a month or so ago,
uh-huh.
and was in the news. But the American Indian Movement, which led a lot of these political protests in the 1970s, had a tremendous impact on Indian, particularly on young people, on mobilizing people. If you want to be sovereign, you have to act sovereign, Russell used to say.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a sort of a, I wouldn't say invisible, but a very difficult for a historian to actually trace. But you meet people all over the country who experienced some aspect of those years, and it really changed and affected them. The last chapter of my book is about Vine Deloria Jr., who was a popular author at that time,
mm-hmm.
Who not only was a part of that movement, but also commented on it and talked about it and so on, and became a mentor for young Indian people and
mm-hmm.
so on.
So
but I would say that that on the one hand, the American Indian movement itself has become a very small and not very, in my opinion, not terribly significant organization, but the ideas behind it really, in some ways, are the kind of the capstone of this process of Indians finding a place in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
And thank you, caller. And I'm afraid, and my apologies to the caller still on the line, we are just about out of time here on Focus. But my thanks to Dr. Frederick Hoxie, who's our guest today, a Swanland Professor of History, Law, and American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois. His new book is This Indian Country, American Indian Political Activists and the History They Made. It's part of the Penguin History of American Life series from the Penguin Press. Believe me, we have only just barely scratched the surface of the information in this book. And Professor Hoxie, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.com. www.williamsburg.edu/focus. And we're likely the first result on your search engine if you type in Will Focus. You now have a second chance to hear this program each weeknight at 8 on WILL AM 580. If you know someone who might enjoy hearing the program but is unable to weekday mornings at 10, let them know about our nightly rebroadcasts at 8 p.m. And if you know someone who might enjoy hearing Focus who lives outside of our listening area, let them know that they can hear it on our website at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back to past programs. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Other members of the Focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and Jim Meadows. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Jim Meadows.